When I was ordained as a novice monk at the age of 16, the first thing they gave me to learn is a book of verses, kind of short poems called gatha, and you have to memorize them. Each poem like that has four lines. And you memorize them in order to practice mindfulness. Suppose before you invite the bell to sound, you breathe in, you breathe out with a verse. Breathing in, you say, body, speech, and mind in perfect oneness. Breathe now, you say, I send my heart along with the sound of this bell. Breathing in, may all of you who listen to me, awaken from your forgetfulness. And breathing out, and transcend the path anxiety and sorrow. And when you breathe in and out with the gatha, practice according to what you read, in silence in your mind, you become very mindful. You are mindful, you are concentrated. And after breathing in and out with the gatha, you are really mindful and concentrated. You can play the role of a bell master. So that is one of the gathas I learned by heart as a novice. And every time I invite the bell to sound, I have to do so. So you are established in the here and the now, concentration and mindfulness in order to do what you are to do. And when you brush your teeth, there is another poem. When you put on your robe, there is another one. When you wash your feet, there is another one. And we begin with 50 verses like that to learn by heart in order to apply to our daily life. Waking up in the morning, there is a poem for you so that you can be in mindfulness right away. Waking up in the morning, I smile. I know that 24 brand new hours are for me to live, a great gift. And I vow to leave them deeply and learn to look at living beings around me with the eyes of compassion. Four lines, breathing in and breathing out before you get out of your bed. And I remember I collected one autumn leaf and I stick to the mosquito net because in Vietnam we had to sleep in a mosquito net. And waking up you see the yellow leaf, and you remember to breathe in and recite the gatha. And later on, we had to write new gathas for our daily use. And I remember the first gatha I wrote is for riding a bicycle, because in old time, monks did not ride bicycle, not to say drive a car. So I am one of the first six monks in Vietnam to ride a bicycle. So mindfulness is the basic practice. When you practice breathing, walking, you can generate the energy of mindfulness. And you can define mindfulness as the kind of energy that allows you to be in the here and the now. You bring your mind back to your body. You are established in the here and the now. You know what is going on in the present moment. If you know what is going on in the present moment because of the energy of mindfulness generated by your practice, what is going on in your body first? Whether is the well-being or stress or tension or pain, you know. And then what is going on in your feelings? There are painful feelings, there are pleasant feelings, and there are mixed feelings, and there are neutral feelings. And when you practice mindfulness of breathing, you might observe your feelings. And you are not attached to any of them. You just recognize them as they are. There's a river of feeling flowing day and night in you. And to meditate is to sit on the bank of the river and observe. A feeling will arise, stay for some time, it will go down and die, and replaced by another feeling. So that is the observation of the feeling. The first realm of mindfulness, object of mindfulness, is your body. Your body is also a river. In that river, there are cells as drops of water. All the cells in our body are drops of water in the river. And there is a sutra called the contemplation of the body. In the body, you just observe your body. And you observe your body and you help your body restore your body rest, your body releasing the tension and so on. It's a wonderful practice, contemplation of the body in the body. You are your body. You are not only an observer, you participate in your body. It's like we ride on the train, we participate. We are one of the ground that find themselves in the train. We are participant, but we are also observer. We observe. We know we are there, and the people are also there. So the first realm of mindfulness is the body. The second realm is the feelings. First of all, you practice mere simple recognition of the feelings. If it is a painful feeling, you just say, breathing in, I know this is a painful feeling. This is a pleasant feeling, you say, breathing out, I know this is a pleasant feeling, a painful feeling, and so on. This is a neutral feeling. And a neutral feeling can be transformed into a painful feeling if you don't know how to take care of it. And a neutral feeling can become a pleasant feeling also. Sitting on the grass, you might feel wonderful in paradise. And with some mindfulness, some feeling that looks like a neutral feeling become a wonderful, pleasant feeling. You feel like being in paradise. But your child may not feel the same. He got bored. The same feeling, but he does not know how to appreciate the green grass, the beautiful spring, and that is why he feel bored and he suffer. He wanted to go in the house and turn on television. So it depends on our way of dealing with the feeling. A neutral feeling can become a pleasant feeling, and can become an unpleasant feeling. It depends on our capacity of looking, of being mindful. When you get some toothache, that is a painful feeling. And when you observe a painful feeling like that, you might get the insight that not to have a toothache is a wonderful thing. enlightenment, that is a kind of enlightenment. But usually when we do not have a toothache, we don't appreciate the non-toothache feeling. We wait until we have a toothache in order to treasure the moment of no non-toothache. And if we remember the moment when we suffer because of toothache, we know how to appreciate a non-toothache moment. And we transform the neutral feeling into a pleasant feeling, a feeling of well-being. And in the river of sensation, in the river of feelings, the majority of the feeling may be neutral feelings. And if you are skillful as a practitioner, you can transform them all into wonderful, pleasant feelings. That is the advantage of meditation. If you don't know how to handle a neutral feeling, they may become painful, boring. But if you know, especially with mindfulness, concentration, and if you know how to compare that feeling with a painful feeling that you experienced in the past, and then that feeling will become a wonderful feeling. So observing the feeling and to know how to handle a feeling is our practice. And if we as school teachers know how to do that, we can tell our students how to do that also. Because the problem of happiness and suffering is the problem of everyone. And the third domain of mindfulness is the domain of mind. There are mental formations. When a mental formation manifests, like anger, fear, joy, happiness, love, we classify something like 52 categories of mental formations. There are positive ones, there are negative ones, and there are neutral ones. Like thinking might be pleasant, thinking might be unpleasant. Thinking might be positive, thinking might be negative. So, mindfulness is also to observe the mental formations, the states of our mind. And as a novice, I had to learn by heart the names of all these feelings. In other, when one of them manifests, I'd be able to call it by its true name and recognize it. Hello, my fear, I know you are there. I will take care of you. We have to know that the name of that feeling, of that mental formation is fear. Hello, my anxiety, I know you are there. I will take care of you. You have to call them by the true names. And then the last area of mindfulness is the objects of your mind. A flower is an object of my perception. The sheet of paper is an object of my perception. Everything I perceive is an object of mine. Objects of mine do exist. I'm not very certain that outside of my mind they really exist. But what I see, I call them objects of mine. What the people in the world call the world, reality, in the Buddhist tradition we call objects of mind. And then we can say very simply that mindfulness is the kind of energy that allow you to know what is going on in the realm of the body, in the realm of the feelings, in the realm of the mind, and in the realm of the objects of the mind. The mountain, The sky, the stars are all objects of our mind. Mindfulness, as we know, is the energy that can help us to be there in the here and the now, body and mind together, so that we can recognize what is going on in these four realms, body, feelings, mind, and objects of mind. And when you are very mindful, when you know how to maintain your mindfulness on that object, another kind of energy is born. It's called concentration. When you are mindful, there is also already some concentration. And if you keep being mindful of that, your concentration begins to grow. And as you have a better concentration, you have a chance to get a breakthrough and understand the very nature of what is there, the object of your mindfulness. Suppose I am mindful of the rose. I know the rose is there for me, for us. And if the rose is interesting, it's very easy for me to focus my attention on the rose. And because I have attention, I am concentrated on the rose, I have a chance to understand the true nature of a rose. And I might discover that a rose is made only of non-rose elements. And when I am able to see the rose, its true nature, its ultimate reality, that kind of insight, that kind of energy is called insight. A deep vision of reality called insight. And that insight, that deep vision of reality is called prajna, great understanding. And that is the third kind of energy. Mindfulness, concentration, and insight. If you are mindful, if you are concentrated enough, you have a chance to get the insight. And that insight may have the power to liberate you from your fear, from your anger. But in this, we call these kind of energies the three trainings. You train in mindfulness, you train in concentration, and you train in insight. And insight is not the outcome of thinking. Insight is kind of direct, intuitive vision that you got from strong concentration. It's not the product of your thinking. It is a deep intuition. And if it is a real insight, it will have the power to free you from your anger, your fear, your suffering. And in Buddhist tradition, we call that kind of insight the insight of interbeing. Interbeing means that you cannot be by yourself alone. You have to interbe with everything else. When you look at into a rose, you see that a rose can never have a separate being. It can never exist by itself alone. Looking into the rose, we see only non-rose elements. The whole cosmos, the whole world of non-rose have come together in order to help the rose to manifest. So the nature of the rose is the nature of interbeing. If you remove all the non-rose elements from the rose disappears. That is why the truth is interbeing, because a rose cannot be by herself alone. And that is true with a star, is true with a human person. A human person, a man, a woman. A man is made only of non-man elements. If you remove non-human elements from the human disappears. If you remove the mineral, the vegetal, the animal elements, there is no longer any human. And that is why our nature is also the nature of interbeing. You cannot be by yourself alone. You have to interbe with all of us, mineral, vegetal, and else. But in our consciousness, there is an inherent belief that we are a separate self. We can be by ourselves alone. And that is why we are caught by the notion of being. With some contemplation, looking deeply, we can see that nothing can be by itself alone. Everything has to interbe with everything else. And intellectually, we may be able to see that. We can recognize that interbeing is the nature of reality. But we can continue to behave as if things can be on themselves. And that is the root of all our problems. And education has something to do with the insight of interbeing. We know that when we practice mindfulness and concentration, we come home to the here and the now. We get in touch with the wonders of life that I can be nourishing and healing. And we can get moments of fulfillment, happiness, satisfaction. And we can develop our love, our understanding. Understanding and love, they are connected to each other. If you do not understand, you cannot love. To love means to understand. And it is impossible for you to love someone unless you understand him or her. You begin by looking deeply, and the moment where you begin to understand the suffering in him or in her, love is born. There can be no love without understanding. And we have a basic need of love and understanding. And that is why we go around in the world looking for love and understanding. We believe that love and understanding should come from the outside, from another person. We are going to look for the person who can fill the vacuum within us with love and understanding. That's what we have been doing, all of us. And meanwhile, not many of us know how to generate the energy of love and understanding. That is why we always feel a kind of vacuum, emptiness inside. And that is why, not having love and understanding, we try to cover up our suffering, our loneliness, our vacuum with consumption. We consume food, we consume music, we consume the internet. We are looking for something. We always long for something. We are always waiting for something, because there is no fulfillment inside. There is no joy. There is not enough peace. There is not enough understanding and love, because we don't know how to generate the energy of joy, of happiness, of understanding, and of love from us. And when you love someone, what can you offer him or her if you do not have love and understanding for yourself? So living according to mindfulness and concentration you can bring in moment of yourself, moments of satisfaction and joy and happiness and love. And if you have this kind of energies, you have something to offer to the other person. You just cannot expect that person to give you what you don't have. I think true good education should be based on an insight, the insight of interbeing. With a mindfulness and concentration, not only we can nourish and heal us, but we can also recognize the suffering, the pain, the sorrow in us in order to bring a relief and to transform. And if teachers know how to do that for themselves, they will be able to transmit that kind of knowledge, that kind of practice to their students. In the center of our consciousness, there is a function of consciousness called manas. They can be translated as the thinking center, the organ of thinking. And it's like in order to see things, you need an organ. The eyes. The eyes is the base for sight. The ear is the sight for hearing, listening. The nose is for perceiving odors. The tongue for the taste and so on. The body, the organ of touch. And thinking should be based on a kind of organ called manas. Manas, we can translate it into a word like cogitation. And in that organ of thinking, there is a lot of misperception. There is an ignorance about the true nature of reality, the nature of interbeing. There is a belief that there is a self separated from the rest, and the self can be by itself alone. So in that kind of, in that organ, in that base, thinking base, there are some misperceptions. First of all, the view of a separate self. Intellectually, we may think that, we may know that nothing can exist by itself alone. But in reality, we still believe, we still behave as there is a separate self. That is a belief in a separate self. That is at the base of most of our thinking and behavior. And that belief on a self is the ground for all kinds of complexes. The complex of superiority is born from that base. The complex of inferiority is born based on that kind of base. And then the complex of equality is also based on that. And all the three complexes bring us a lot of suffering. The belief in a separate self. And that is why the practice of looking deeply, the practice of meditation, help us to touch the nature of interbeing and help us to develop the kind of wisdom, the kind of insight called the wisdom of non-discrimination. discrimination is the roots of a lot of suffering in the world. Discrimination between self and non-self, and not self. Discrimination between rose and non-rose. Imagine a rose discriminating against non-rose elements. She is discriminating against herself because she is made only of non-rose element. In the Buddhist way of thinking, we learn that a rose is made only of non-rose elements, and a Buddha is made only of non-Buddha elements. When you look into a Buddha, you only see non-Buddha elements. Again, when I was 16 as a novice, my teacher told me how to bow to a Buddha. Before you bow to the Buddha, you have to use a gatha, to use a verse. And the verse is like this. The one who bow and the one who is bowed to, both are equally empty of a separate self. Buddha, you are made of non-Buddha elements. Me, I am made of non-me elements. I am divided of a separate self, and you, the Buddha, you are also divided of a separate self. And that is why communication can be very deep. And then you bow. And there will be communication, communion. And if you are only you, and the Buddha is only the Buddha, no communication can be real, can be true, can be possible. Communication is good. Communication is deep. Communication is possible because the Buddha, because of the insight that the Buddha is made only of non-Buddha element, and me, I am not made only of non-me element. So, dear Buddha, I am in you. When I bow to you, I bow to myself. And you are in me. So I am the bower, but I am also the one who is bowed to. That is the wisdom of non-discrimination. And with that, there is no more separation. There will be peace, understanding, and happiness, and non-fear. It's like my left hand and my right hand. Each hand is different. Each hand has a name, right hand, left hand. But looking into my two hands, I see that there is the wisdom of non-discrimination, Nirvikalpa Jnana. There is peace, collaboration, deep understanding between my two hands. They never fight against each other. There is no complex of superiority of one over the other. You know, my right hand used to do many things like inviting the bell, writing a letter, doing calligraphy, but she's not proud of that. She never looked down on my left hand. She never said that, well, my left hand, you seem not to to do much. Everything I do, all poems of Thai, it's me who write. That's not the thinking of my right hand, because she is absolutely free from the superiority complex and so on. And my left hand, she doesn't have any inferiority complex. One day, my left hand was holding a nail, and my right hand a hammer. We were trying to hang a picture. And that day, my right hand was not very mindful. Instead of pounding on the nail, it pounded on the finger. So right away, it put down the hammer and took very good care of the left hand. as if it takes care of itself. It does not say, left hand, you know, I'm sorry. I make you suffer. But I'm taking good care of you. Remember, when I suffer, you should also do like that. You should take care of me. And that is why both hands are free from all kind of complexes, superiority, inferiority, even equality. Because when you don't compare anymore, even the notion of equality disappear. I am equal to you. I'm not less good than you. That is also a complex. Because you are me, I am you. You are in me, and I am in you. And the same thing with the five fingers. The five fingers, they look different. This one is smallest, but she does not have any complex of inferiority. And this, no complex of superiority. That is why the wisdom of non-discrimination is a reality that can exist. And that is why my left hand can do so many things. Imagine if the five fingers are exactly the same size, they cannot do much. And that is why my left hand can do a lot of things and can collaborate perfectly with my right hand. That is the wisdom of non-discrimination, the outcome of the practice of looking deeply. When you have touched the nature of interbeing, you don't discriminate anymore between the Buddha and you, between the rose and non-rose elements, and happiness become possible. So in the field of education, the same thing should be true. The happiness of the students are the happiness of the teachers. And the happiness of our colleagues are our own happiness. That is why we have to learn to look in such a way that collaboration could be possible so that we can change the present situation into a situation where we can enjoy the teaching and the learning. In the Buddhist tradition, we speak of the four noble truths, and the first one is ill-being, suffering. And in the field of education, the first thing we should do is to identify the suffering, to call our suffering by its true name. We have to touch the first noble truth before we can go far. We have to acknowledge the fact that there is a lot of suffering, frustration, stress, burnout, anger, violence, discrimination. And not only teachers suffer, but also the students suffer. We have to recognize the many aspects of the suffering, like 60-70% of the students have to use medication in order to continue, and teachers also. And when we suffer so much, we cannot do our work so well. So we have to write down the kind of suffering that we are going through, and we have to acknowledge to each other. If our colleagues are with us or are opposing us, we know that they suffer very much the same thing. And when we suffer very much the same thing, we should sit down together and look for a way out. So not only we can work with those who agree with us, but we can and work with those who do not agree with us, because in them there is very much the same kind of suffering. If you think that the current educational system is bringing a lot of suffering to us, we have to say in a collective voice, because in order to change the system, we have to change our way of thinking, our consciousness. We have to see the truth, and we have to help our colleagues to see the truth, so that we can come to a point where we can speak with one voice, that this is suffering, and we do not want to continue with this. We want change. And there must be ways in order to voice that together. Maybe some freshness, some practice of compassionate listening, some practice of loving speech should be used in order to communicate well, so that together we can express our concern. If we know that there is a collective change in our way of thinking, of seeing things concerning the educational system, and then we hope that real change will happen. A collective awakening, a collective recognition of the suffering is the starting point. We can give a speech, we can write an article, we can organize a symposium, we can organize a conference, we can do many things in order to bring about awareness of suffering. If we are caught in the current educational system, and then we have to run with the system, there will be a moment when we will burn out, and we have to get sick, and the student also gets sick. And what is the use of being in the top school, in the best kind of college, in the best kind of job, if we do not have well-being anymore? So that is why we have to redefine, we have to reconsider the notion of happiness, the notion of success. If we have a clear notion of success and happiness, and then we have enough strength in order to refuse the current continuation leading to our destruction, leading to the destruction that of those who want to serve, who want to help. The first noble truth is suffering. We have to got the time to look deeply into the nature of suffering. We should be able to call it by its true name. And then we can look into the second noble truth, which is the making of the suffering. Why do we have to run like this? Why do we have to continue like this? We have no time to nourish ourselves, to heal ourselves, to take care of ourselves. We don't have the time to be for our beloved ones. We are forced to lose our well-being in the process of going ahead. And unless we find the second noble truth, which is the making, why? The making of ill being. And then we cannot find the way out, which is the fourth noble truth, the way leading to the end of suffering, the way leading to the beginning of well-being, which is the third noble truth. I would like to say a few words about Sangha building, the community of teachers. Sangha is a group of people who support each other, who come to each other in order to practice looking deeply into our real situation and try to find a way out. Sangha is a group of people who support each other in trying to nourish ourselves, to heal ourselves, so that we can continue for a long time, not to burn out. And I would like to say a few things about our experience of Sangha building. I left the country 45 years ago, trying to speak against the killing. And they did not want me to go home. So I had to be in exile for more than 40 years. And during that time, I tried to continue my practice and try to set up groups of friends to continue the practice I had initiated in a Buddhist monastery. We organize sitting, walking, looking deeply, breathing, and so on. We have set up many practice centers. And there are centers where we live by many hundreds. Like in Plum Village, we are several hundreds of people living together, monastics and lay people. And our lifestyle is quite simple. No one of us has a salary. No one of us has a private bank account. No one of us has a private house, a private car, a private telephone. Everything is communal. And we are able to reduce the number of cars to one-tenth. We live simply, we garden, we practice, and recognize the practice for many people to come. And we go and offer retreats like that in many cities, in many world. And the practice is very much like the practice we have during this retreat. Sitting, walking, eating in silence, try to do everything in mindfulness, and building brotherhood, sisterhood, sustaining us, giving us enough joy to continue. Speaking of walking, for instance, in Plum Village, there is only one style of walking. Mindful walking. It's not only 1 hour of walking meditation, but every time we move from one place to another, we are supposed to apply the techniques of mindful walking to enjoy our every step. And that is why we can rest, we can enjoy every moment of our walking. Walking from the living quarter to the meditation hall or to the kitchen to work, to cook for the Sangha. You stop your thinking, you just focus your attention on each step and release the tension. We train to do like that. Every time we hear the bell, we stop doing whatever we are doing. We stop the thinking. We focus our attention on the sound of the bell and on mindful breathing to restore ourselves. Every time the clock play the music, each quarter an hour, we stop eating or talking or discussing and go back to ourselves and enjoy breathing in and out. So the chance, the time to stop and relax and renew ourselves is plenty during the day. And please do not imagine that we don't do a lot of things. We do a lot of things. We organize a lot of retreats. We do it slowly, relaxingly, but we are able to do many things. And none of us have a salary. We have some pocket money to buy things like what we toothpaste and so on. Every week we have one day called a lazy day. It's not a rest day, but a lazy day. You try to be as lazy as possible. Because many of us can be addicted to be doing something. We don't feel peaceful and happy if we are not doing something. It has become a habit. We must be always doing something. And in the lazy day, you try not to do anything. You try to allow your body, your mind to rest completely. And that is a deep practice. To be lazy is not so easy. And when you meet a brother or sister on your path, you look at him and smile and say, "Brother, are you lazy enough today?" So total relaxation, walking, lying down, doing anything in order to restore yourself. And especially to get in touch with the wonders of life in yourself, around you, for your renewal, for your restoration, for your healing. Go back to Mother Earth. Allow Mother Earth to embrace you and heal you and nourish you. You can walk alone. You can invite another brother to walk with you. You can do anything, provided you are truly lazy. You are not carried away by a project, a work. You allow yourself to be in a situation having nothing to do and having nowhere to go. And that is to protect ourselves, to keep ourselves from being carried away from burnout. And that is possible because we live in community. It is possible to do it alone, but it's much, much more difficult. You are surrounded by other people who practice very much the same thing. Everyone around you walk relaxingly, mindfully, and then enjoy every step. So if you find yourself among that group of people, it's so easy for you to do the same. And every time there is a bell of mindfulness or the bell of the church nearby, everyone pause and enjoy breathing, so you do the same. So in community, living in community, it's very easy to practice mindfulness and relax and allow yourself to be restored. And then we can sit down and we can share our experience of practice. We can offer each other the way to overcome difficulties and to nourish ourselves. Therefore, it's my conviction that teachers have to organize themselves into communities. They have to come together in order to support each other, creating the kind of lifestyle that can sustain them for a long time. They can come and practice together a session of walking meditation, a session of sitting, quiet sitting, enjoying a mindful meal, discuss on how to overcome such or such difficulties and so on. I think Sangha building is very important. There is what we call a habit energy, patterns of behavior that we have to recognize with mindfulness and concentration. There is a question as if we are too mindful, and then we will not, we may not act spontaneously. We will lose our spontaneity. It's not true, because what you call spontaneity may be just a habit, energy, or a pattern of behavior. We have the tendency to say things, to do things that can cause harm to ourselves and to other people. Then after having caused the suffering, we regret. It's not because we don't know that saying such a thing will cause damage, doing such a thing will bring suffering. We know very well. And yet, there is a habit, there is a pattern of behavior that push us to say it and to do it. Even if we know saying it and doing that will bring suffering. And every one of us has that kind of habit energy. So mindfulness or breathing or walking help us to recognize the habit when it shows. It manifests. Sometimes we call it, it's stronger than us. After having said that, after having done that, we regret, we beat our chest, and we promise that next time we will not do it, we will not say it. And yet, next time when the situation presents itself, we will do it again, and we say it again. And that is why mindfulness is a very wonderful way in order to recognize the happy energy You don't have to fight that habit energy. You only have to recognize. And when you can recognize it, it will lose its power. It will not push you to do it anymore, to say it anymore. It's very important. And living in a community, this becomes easier. Because not only you have your own mindfulness, but your colleagues also have their own mindfulness. They can remind you. They can help you. We are co-practitioners and we support each other. That is why Sangha building is very important. There is dormant tendencies in us. The first tendency, it looks natural, but it is a habit energy. We are naturally, we have always the tendency to seek, to go for pleasure seeking. And this is the truth. There is some vacuum, there is suffering, there is loneliness in us that push us to go and look for pleasure. So pleasure seeking is a tendency in us. And yet we forget, we ignore the danger of pleasure seeking. There is a tendency to go for, to seek pleasure, but there is also the ignorance about the dangers involved with the pleasure seeking. The next tendency is the tendency to avoid suffering. We try to avoid suffering. And that is why you don't want to go home to get in touch with suffering, to listen to the suffering inside in order to understand suffering and to transform it. We try always to run away. And that is a tendency also, trying to run away, to escape from suffering. And also there is that ignorance. We do not see the goodness of suffering. We can learn a lot from suffering. Suffering can instruct us a lot. And suffering can help us recognize happiness. Suffering is a kind of background. When there is something white, and if you put it on against the white background, you cannot recognize it so well. But if you put white on a background of black or brown, you can see it so well. So against the background of suffering, you can recognize your happiness. So suffering play a very, very important role. Mindfulness of suffering is something very good. If you are an astronaut, having spent 6 months in the sky lab, and if you are allowed to go home to the Earth, you will enjoy every step you make on Earth. Each step brings you a lot of happiness. It's a wonder to be making steps on a dirt path and the green grass and the creek, so beautiful, so wonderful. You enjoy very much going back to the earth, but 6 months after, you might lose your happiness. you take it for granted the happiness that you are having, so you don't feel happy anymore. And if you remember the time you were on the Skylab, it's so difficult. You always float. There's no gravity. You cannot lie down. You are always float. Even when you sit at the table in order to eat your lunch, you have to look, to use your leg in order to lock yourself so that you will not float. And it's so difficult up there. And that is why when you go home to the earth, you feel so happy. So the moment when the astronaut remember the situation, the time in the Skylab, happiness is born again. The background of suffering allowed us to recognize the happiness that we are having now. And that is why mindfulness helps us to recognize the goodness of suffering. Suffering play a good part, an important part in making happiness. It is like a lotus flower. When you look into a lotus flower, you see the beauty, the fragrance, but you know that there is the mud. You cannot grow lotus on marble. You have to grow lotus in the mud. Without the mud, there is no lotus flower. So happiness is made of non-happiness elements, including suffering. And that is why understanding suffering, recognize the goodness of suffering, making good use of the suffering is a way to create happiness. So that these are four tendencies of manas, the thinking base in our consciousness. The tendency to go for pleasure seeking. The tendency to avoid suffering. The tendency, the ignorance about the danger involved with pleasure seeking. The tendency to ignore the goodness of suffering, the positive things that suffering can bring about. And the fifth is the ignorance about the law of moderation. And that is involved with manas, the center of thinking in us. So when we meditate, we can get the insight of interbeing so that we can free ourselves from the ignorance about the existence of a separate self. We will find out that happiness and suffering are no longer individual matters. And the five, the insight of interbeing, the wisdom of non-discrimination can be the foundation of the kind of global ethics that we can practice, so that we can transform and heal ourselves, transform and heal society. We have the five mindfulness trainings. The five trainings that is based on the insight of interbeing, on the insight of non-discrimination. And the first mindfulness training is about protecting life on the planet Earth. According to the insight of interbeing, humans are made only of non-human elements, namely the mineral, the vegetal, and the animals. And if we harm other species, we harm ourselves. And we are not something separate from the environment. We are the environment. We are made only of non-us element. And if we continue to harm the non-us, non-human elements, we are harming the human elements. That's why protecting life is the first practice for happiness. That is the first practice of mindfulness. To protect life, to protect the right of being alive of other species. And our teaching, our way of life should follow the line of reverence for life. And the second mindfulness training is about true happiness. True happiness. Looking deeply, we see that true happiness does not depend on favor, wealth, power, and sex. True happiness would be impossible without the two ingredients, understanding and love. Even if strong competition with big success, with big fame, with wealth, happiness will not be possible without understanding and love, compassion. That is why in order to reach happiness, we should cultivate understanding and compassion. This is true for everyone. Whether you are a politician, or a businessman, or a school teacher, or a student. And that is why the realm, the aim of education is to help people generating love and understanding, the main purpose of education. If an educational system does not have that, it is not a good one, because happiness is not possible without understanding and compassion. Understanding is first of all understanding of the suffering inside and the suffering of the other person of the world. Understanding brings about compassion. And you are no longer angry, you are no longer trying to kill, to suppress, to eliminate. So the second mindfulness training about true happiness has to do with protecting life, the first training. So the question we should ask, is our education system capable of generating more understanding and compassion and love? If to educate means only to transmit technical knowledge, intellectual luggage, that's not enough. In that case, school teachers have to transmit the knowledge as how to generate understanding and compassion. And that is why subjects like how to calm yourself, how to release the tension within your body, how to deal with a painful emotion, how to deal with the painful feelings, how to use loving speech and deep listening to restore communication. All these things are very crucial. It would be a pity if in a classroom you do not have a chance to teach and learn these things. And if school teachers master this kind of knowledge and techniques and practice, they could be able to transmit them to the students. That is global ethics. That is what we should teach and learn, because it has to do with true happiness. That is why we have to change our idea of happiness, of success. What is the use of having a diploma of a higher job, a situation, if there is no happiness? If there is no understanding and compassion, there is no happiness. So no position, no success can be worth our sacrificing our life for it. That's true happiness. And then the third mindfulness training is about true love. And we know that true love is born from understanding. If you don't understand someone, it's impossible for you to love him or make him happy. A husband that does not understand his wife, no matter what he does, he cannot make his wife happy. That is why he has to inquire about the suffering, the difficulty of his wife. Darling, please tell me of your suffering, of your difficulties. I want to understand. If I understand, I will not do the things that make you suffer, and I'll be able to make you happy. Understanding is the foundation of love. Where there is understanding, there is love already. So a father has to see the difficulties and the suffering of his son in order to truly love him and make him happy. And if he really understands his son, he will no longer want to impose his ideas, his way on his son. Understanding is the key for love. And then in true love, we learn that sexual desire and love, they are quite different things, two different things. But nowadays, the young people, not only the young people, they mix up between the two. They think that sexual desire and love is the same thing. No. True love can only bring happiness, and sexual desire can destroy it. Especially when it is empty sex destroy love and does not give a chance for a person to experience true love. And our society is being caught in that kind of notion, idea. We have to tell the young people, love, true love is something so precious, fundamental for true happiness. And that is why true love always involve reverence, respect. If there is no respect, there is no reverence, there is no love. The nature of my love is reverence. We have to respect ourselves. We have to respect our body. And we have to respect the body of the other person, because body and mind, they are together. Mind is made with body, and body is made with mind. the body is made of non-body elements, and the mind is made of non-mind elements into being. So if you don't respect the body, you don't respect the mind. Reverence is the foundation of true love. If there is no reverence, no respect, there is no love. Sexual activity motivated by craving always harm oneself as well as others. I am determined not to engage in sexual relations without true love and a deep long-term commitment made known to my family and friends. I will do everything in my power to protect children from sexual abuse and to prevent couples and families from being broken by sexual misconduct. Seeing that body and mind are one, I am committed to learning appropriate ways to take care of my sexual energy and cultivating loving-kindness, compassion, joy, inclusiveness, which are the four basic elements of true love. These things should be taught in school, true love. The four ingredients of true love, first of all, is loving-kindness, the capacity to offer happiness. If you are not capable of making the other person happy, you don't have true love. The second ingredient of true love is compassion. Compassion has power to remove the suffering from him or her, transform the suffering from him, in him and in her. If you do not have the power to help him or her suffer less, you don't have true love yet. You have to learn. And joy is the third component of true love. If your love is not offering joy to him or to her, if you make him or her cry all the time, that's not true love. So the power to offer joy is the third ingredient of true love. And the fourth element of true love is inclusiveness, non-discrimination. In true love, there is no I and you anymore. Your suffering is my suffering. And my happiness is your happiness. It's no longer any frontier between the two. And the children should learn that. And the fourth mindfulness training is the practice of loving speech and deep listening. This is a very important instrument to restore communication and to reconcile. To reconcile between nations, between warring parties, between parties in conflicts, between husband and wife, between father and son, and so on. We know that both parties suffer. And we have the tendency to believe that we alone suffer. The other person does not suffer. He only make me suffer. That's what we believe. But the fact is that they are suffering inside of me, but they are suffering inside of him also. And if I recognize the suffering in me, and I find out that most of the suffering in me are born from my ignorance, my wrong perceptions, I will suffer less. And when I look at him or at her, I can recognize his or her suffering right away. And when I acknowledge the suffering in him or in her, I feel sorry for him or for her. I don't want to punish anymore. I don't want to kill, to suppress anymore. I want to help him, to suffer less. Even if he is a terrorist, he's a criminal. He's a terrorist, he's criminal because there is a lot of suffering in him, a lot of anger, a lot of fear in him. And nobody so far has helped him to remove that anger, that fear, that despair. So if I look deeply and I see the suffering in that person, I will not want to kill him anymore. I will not want to punish him anymore. Instead, compassion in me tell me to look for a way in order to help that person to suffer less and to begin experiencing the joy of living. And then naturally, he will stop being a terrorist, a criminal. And listening to someone suffering is a very deep practice. And we have to train ourselves. Because someone, while speaking, may have a tendency to accuse, to blame. And it's difficult for us to sit there and listen. Because what the other person say can touch off the irritation, the anger in us. And when we are overwhelmed by irritation and anger, we lose our capacity of listening. So the practice of listening requires mindfulness of compassion. I think all psychotherapists have some degree of compassionate listening if they are successful therapists. They have to sit and listen in such a way that the other person feel that he or she suffer less thanks to this capacity of listening. And that's called a compassionate listening. Compassionate listening is to listen in such a way that you can still preserve compassion in your heart. And that is called mindfulness of compassion. And everyone can do. If we remind ourselves only just one thing, I'm sitting here and I'm listening to him just with one purpose. I listen in order to help him to speak out and to suffer less. Just remember that. The purpose of our mind listening is to help him to have a chance to speak out and suffer less. And if we remember that, we maintain that awareness alive, we are protected by compassion. It's called mindfulness of compassion. The other person, while speaking, may use words of blaming, accusing, and what he say may be full of wrong perceptions, wrong informations. And yet, because we are armed, we are protected by compassion. That is why these accusations, these blames, these wrong perceptions will not touch off our irritation and anger. We continue to listen with compassion because that is what we want to do. We want him to suffer less. And that's why we don't interrupt him or her while listening. Because if we do, we transform the session of listening to a kind of debate, and we ruin the whole thing. And that is why awareness of compassion, mindfulness of compassion, is what we have to practice during the time we listen. Just remind us that I listen to him like this with only one purpose, helping him to speak out and to suffer less. And you are protected. And when there is some wrong information, you smile inside, you said, well, poor fellow, he's victim of so many wrong perceptions, but I will not interrupt him now. Later on, in 3 or 4 days, I will have a chance to offer him some information so that he can correct his perception, but not now. And you continue to listen with compassion. You are not in a hurry to correct him or her. And 1 hour of listening like that can be very healing. And you are a bodhisattva, you are a Buddha of compassion. Why you sit and listen like that? You begin like this, darling. I know you have suffered a lot during the past many years. You can tell your son or your daughter. You can tell your spouse. You can tell your father and your mother like that also. I know that you have suffered a lot during the past many years. I was not able to help you to suffer less. I'm sorry. Instead, I have made the situation worse. I have reacted with anger, stubbornness, and so on. I'm sorry. It's not my intention to make you suffer. It's because I did not understand your suffering and your difficulties. So you should help me, my dear. You should tell me about your suffering, your difficulties, so that I will learn and understand. Once I have understood, I will not react like before and make you suffer anymore. Please help me. If you don't help me, who will help me? That is what we call loving speech. And with compassion, it's sure that we can use loving speech. And compassion is possible when you recognize the suffering in him or in her, seeing that she is the victim of her own suffering. That person does not know how to handle suffering, how to transform his suffering. And that insight helps you to be compassionate. And with some compassion in your heart, you will be capable of using loving speech. Darling, I know you suffer a lot. I'm sorry I could not help you. I have reacted unskillfully because I was ignorant about your suffering, your difficulties. Please, so help me. We can address our father, our mother, our son, our daughter, our husband, our wife, that way. And after that, he or she will open the door of his heart and tell us. And now we have a chance to practice compassionate listening. I believe that peace negotiations should follow this pattern also. Because both warring parties, they suffer. And they believe that only their party suffer, the other party only make them suffer. In Plum Village, we have sponsored many groups of Palestinians and Israelis to come and practice with us. It was difficult. It is always difficult in the beginning. There's a lot of suspicion and anger. But after a week of practicing calming body and emotion, and then there is the initiation into the practice of deep listening. One party could sit down, breathing in and out, practicing mindfulness and compassion in order to listen to the other group. The other group is advised to tell everything in their heart, the suffering of adults and children from their part, and try to use the kind of language that does not have much accusation and blames, so that to help the other side to listen more easily. You have the right to tell the other party all kind of suffering that you have undergone, and you don't blame. That makes it easier for them to listen. And after a few sessions of listening like that, you recognize that on the other side, they have suffered exactly like on your side. And suddenly you see that they are human beings like you. And suddenly your way of looking at them changes. There is compassion, understanding in your eyes. And that is what happened during our retreat with Palestinians and Israelis. And if they have wrong perceptions, we promise to ourselves that in the next few days we will have a chance to give them information so that they can correct their perceptions, but not now. And both parties, both groups, have equal chance to listen and to speak. And it always works. And they, both groups begin to share walking meditation together, sitting together, sharing a meal together, and reconcile. And at the end of the retreat, they always come together as one group and report about the success of their practice to the whole community, and promise that they, when they go back to the Middle East, they will organize sessions of practice like that for other people to come and practice and suffer less. So the fourth mindfulness training is about the practice of loving speech and deep listening that has the power to help each other to suffer less, the power to restore communication and bring about reconciliation. And this should be taught in school. And school teachers have to master the techniques before they can transmit the knowledge and the practice to the students. And students, they can go home and practice with their parents. And if we know the practice, we see that it's not as difficult as we might have thought. There's a monk there's a young man who was ordained by us in Plum Village without the consentment of his father. His father is a high communist cadre, and this young man was not satisfied with that way of life. He want to practice compassion and so on. So they did not talk to each other for a long time. He did not, he telephoned, his father did not answer. He wrote letter, his father never answered. So one day I initiate the young monk into the practice of loving speech, and I instructed him how to write a letter of love. And the letter was something like this: "Daddy, I live in Plum Village with many monks. And from time to time they told me that I have this quality, that's virtue, like working hard, fidelity and things like that. And in the beginning I did not believe them, that I have these qualities. But they kept telling me that I have these qualities, and finally I believe that I have these qualities. And I asked myself, why, where these qualities have come from? And I find that it must have come from you. Because parents transmit to their children their strength and their weaknesses. And if I have these qualities, I know that they have been transmitted to me by my ancestors and my parents. So I'm very eager to understand more about my ancestors, my parents. So could you please tell me more about my grandmother, my grandfather, my ancestors, and how you live your life when you were young? I'm so eager to learn, Daddy. Only that letter. Then this time he got a 10-page letter from his father, telling him many things, and they restore communication very easily like that. It's not as difficult as you might think. When you have some compassion within yourself, you are able to use loving speech and deep listening. And this instrument will always help to restore communication and bring about reconciliation. And children coming to our retreat, when they go back to their family, they are capable of reconciling with their father, their mother, their parents. And not only we can help the child to have a second chance by transforming the classroom into a family where he can learn understanding and love, which he did not get from his family. We can also bring this kind of realization and help transform the family of the child. The fifth mindfulness training is about nourishment and healing. It is about mindful consumption. To consume in such a way that you will not destroy your body and your consciousness with toxins. And because there is the feeling of emptiness, vacuum, loneliness, suffering inside, we tend to cover up this block of suffering by the way of consuming. And the market provide us with all kind of items so that we can consume and cover up the suffering inside. And the more we consume, the worse will become the situation. And because what we consume may be full of toxins. And equally, among the items we consume may be there is alcohol, drugs, TV programs, films, magazines, and even conversations that may be full of anger, frustration, and despair. And we get that kind of nutriment every day. How can we not get sick? There's a lot of violence, despair, fear, anger in what we consume every day. And we destroy ourselves by way. We want to survive. We want to forget our suffering by consuming. But while consuming, we bring more suffering into our body and mind. That is why the way out is mindful consumption. That is the fifth training. In Plum Village, we don't eat meat, we don't use dairy products. But that does not mean we don't drink alcohol, beer, and so on. But that does not mean that we suffer. No, we don't suffer at all. The vegetarian cooking that we have in Plum Village, so we love it. We do not deprive ourselves of good food, but good food is possible without harming environment and so on. And we learn to eat and drink in such a way to preserve the well-being of our body and to allow ourselves to retain compassion. In the five contemplations that we read every time we begin a meal, that This food is a gift of the cosmos, Father Sky and Mother Earth. And we vow to eat in such a way that we can preserve compassion in us, to eat in such a way that can help reduce the suffering of living beings on Earth, and help preserve our planet and reverse the process of global warming. And we can live in such a way that make a future to be possible for our planet, for our next generations. And that brings a lot of satisfaction and fulfillment. Aware of the suffering caused by unmindful consumption, I am committed to cultivating good health, both physical and mental, for myself, my family, and my society by practicing mindful eating, drinking, and consuming. I will practice looking deeply into my consumption of the four kinds of nutrients, namely edible food, sense impressions, including internet, television, films, and so on, volition and consciousness. Collective consciousness is food. If you live in a neighborhood that is full of violence and fear and anger, you consume. If you live in a community where understanding, joy, and compassion can be generated every day, you consume. That's good food. Collective consciousness. Hope, brotherhood, sisterhood, joy that can be generated by your daily life. So collective consciousness is food. And if we live in a neighborhood where the collective consciousness is only anger, despair, we know that we will be contaminated. We will die because of that. That is why we have to move out as quickly as possible to an environment where you can consume other kind of collective consciousness, brotherhood, sisterhood, hope, compassion, understanding. And that is why creating communities of mindful living, compassionate listening, is our way out. I will practice coming back to the present moment, to be in touch with the refreshing, healing, and nourishing elements in me and around me. Not letting regrets and sorrow drag me back into the past, or letting anxiety, fear, or craving pull me out of the present moment. I am determined not to try to cover up loneliness, anxiety, and other suffering by losing myself in consumption. I will contemplate, interbeing, and consume in a way that preserves peace, joy, and well-being in my body and consciousness, and in the collective body and consciousness of my family, my society, and our Earth. So we try to put the practice of mindfulness in concrete terms called the five trainings, an art of living mindfully and happily and sanely. The first training is how to protect life, how to protect our planet, how to assure a future. The second is true happiness, not based on the success in terms of fame, power, sex, and money, but on our capacity to generate the energy of understanding and compassion. The third mindfulness training is about true love. the kind of love that can only bring joy and happiness, not destructive to the body and to the mind. The fourth training is about loving speech and deep listening to restore communication and reconcile. And the fifth is about mindful consumption to assure a healthy body and mind, a healthy society. So this can be brought into school, and we should need something like a national Dharma discussion, a national debate on happiness, in order to be able to bring this kind of teaching and practice into school. It is my conviction that happy teachers who know how to generate understanding and love will help the younger generation change the world.